Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Erin Welch, good afternoon. Listeners will know you best from your Trainspotting series of novels and the films they spawned, but it's music that's bringing you to Wicklow in a fortnight to perform a DJ set at the Beyond the Pale Music and Arts Festival. So we've asked you to do a mini set for us here this afternoon, and you've picked five pieces of music that remind you of significant moments in your life. Welcome to the show. Tell me about music growing up in your house. What did it sound like?
It sounded a lot like, I mean, it was like my mum and dad loved Frank Sinatra and Elvis and the Beatles and all that, you know. So I kind of grew up listening to all that sort of, getting into all that kind of stuff. There's always quite raucous parties where people would sing and all, you know. So I grew up in a sort of, there was my Uncle Jack was played piano and all that, and there was just a kind of general vibe and almost associated music with partying, basically. Yeah.
And did your parents, I think your mom was a waitress and your dad a carpet salesman, they instilled in you that love of music clearly. What about, you know, books and writing? How much of that came from your parents?
Quite a lot. There was always kind of, there was always books around. They were both big readers, and they always had, there was always some kind of, you know, sort of big book that was around. And one of my uncles did was a fireman. He did an Open University degree, and basically everybody just, you know, the books went from him to my dad, and then from my dad to myself and all that. So I got a lot of stuff that you wouldn't normally kind of come into contact with, kind of writers like Evelyn Waugh and you know, the Brontes and all that kind of classic kind of English literature. And I was sort of, I was kind of quite exposed to that, I think. And it's kind of, you know, it felt like, compared to a lot of other kids, I was quite fortunate. I had a pretty kind of sort of big kind of lot of encouragement culturally, really.
And so you're reading the classics, reading local authors, and then outside of books and just investing yourself in that whole world of adventures and make-believe, what about storytelling? That was, I believe, something that was really valued in your home, as very much a part of the community, the pub lifestyle that you really loved.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, some of the guys in my family, like the men in particular, but sometimes the women as well, they were great storytellers. You know, they could just sort of hold the floor and mesmerize you, and they were sort of very big into Robert Burns and all that. You know, there was a sort of it was just part of the culture that you could actually, you know, you could spin a tale, basically. And a lot of and I grew up kind of fascinated by, not just by the older guys in the pubs telling their stories, but also by my peers. Some of my mates were just brilliant raconteurs and storytellers. So I sort of, it just seemed to be something that was in the water, really.
Tell me about your first music choice, which is Hypnosis by Mudd.
Yeah, I mean, I love Mike Chapman, basically. The guy wrote the 70s, you know, he wrote kind of Mudd and The Sweet and just about everybody, really, you know. I mean, he sort of, he made all these mad kind of hit records. And Hypnosis by Mudd, I liked the lyrics to it, and I liked, it was like, it's just about a guy being mesmerised and hypnotised by this girl that he's kind of fallen for. And I think that I've kind of, you know, I had a big crush on this girl when I was at school. I had a big crush on a lot of girls when I was at school. One in particular kind of just mesmerised me, you know. She just whenever she walked into a room, my eyes just about fell out, basically, and I could barely breathe, basically, you know. So she put a hex on me, and I think that this is what kind of happens when you fall for someone, that you're kind of powerless to resist, basically.
Well, let's take you back to that moment in time of being mesmerised. Take a listen to Hypnosis by Mudd.
Oh. Oh. La,
That was Mud with Hypnosis, the first music choice this afternoon of my guest, writer Irvin Welsh. We're going to come to Trainspotting soon, which was your first novel in 1993 when you were around, I think, the age of 35. But you left school at 16 and took up a wide range of eclectic jobs before you took up full-time writing. Irvin, tell us about the squiggly career and the range of jobs you were invested in over those years.
If you look at a lot of writers, They basically become writers because, you know, they're unsuited to 9-to-5 work. You know, it's like I was always unsuited to any, you know, 9-to-5 work, and I could hold a job down for about a year and function in it, and then I got really bored with it, I would move on, or I would kind of get flung out of them. And I think, you know, if you look at every writer that I know, he basically, for a certain generation, the kind of dull generation, you see all these kind of occupations that they've had, and I think it is a bit like that. You're trying to find something that you're good at, and you know, and I think if you're drawn to writing, you want a lot of different occupations, so you can, you want to experience a lot of things and have a lot of stories to tell and meet a lot of people from different backgrounds. And I was very much like that, you know. I kind of I hated work. I hated physical work. I hated working on building sites. I hated working in kitchens, which were incredibly just hot.
But you did it. You did the dishwashing, yeah, and the portering and the paving roads. But presumably that was to pay for the passion project that was maybe then, yeah, music, but would become writing.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, it was like everything. Work was always instrumental. I kind of, you know, I was into living for the weekend, basically, and you know, into sort of playing in bands and sort of trying to kind of to sort of get into it. But I was no, you know, we were no Mud, and I was no Les Gray, you know. So you know, we struggled, and I struggled most of all because I didn't have any real musicianship skills. You know, I didn't have any keyboarding or fretboarding skills. So I was always the first one kicked out of the band when they got a bit proficient.
And you did find your way back to Edinburgh, working in local government. I think it was as the head of training at the Economic Development Department. When you reflect back on that, did that just eventually unlock the love of writing? I think you started to write Trainspotting while in the local civil service job.
Well, I mean, it was local government. I did that in London and in Edinburgh. And it's the thing about the very good thing about working in local government is that you have to write loads, you have to write big reports, which nobody reads, you know. They just read the one page kind of summary at the top of the report. But you have the bigger and thicker the report you have, the more chance you're getting it passed as council policy. So you learn to smash out loads of words. And I think that was the thing that was missing for me. I always had the ideas, but I never really had the discipline to knock out loads of words. And then I realised, well, yeah, I can do this. Knock out loads of words are kind of trivial nonsense, really, like, you know. But so I just transferred that to doing something that I like, you know. So, you know, I can knock out words and doing something that I don't really care about. If I was motivated to do something that I really like, you know, I could really go to town on it. And it was a great skill to have, that ability to knock out words.
Yeah, and you found your love and calling through it. Tell me about your second music selection this morning. It's Gloria, which most people will know from Laura Branigan's cover, but you've picked the original Umberto Tozzi version from 1979. Why that choice?
Yeah, I love Italian disco, and I love kind of, I just think it's better, and it's kind of, It's kind of cooler and camper, and I just I love the song, and I do like Laura Branigan's version of it as well. But I love Umberto's version of it, and there's a really good remix for a really good kind of modern dance, kind of housey remix of Umberto Tozzi's version, and it's just fabulous. I mean, I remember I think it was I was at this gig in Paddington, and I think it was Paul Zimmerman from The Clash that was that dropped it. He was playing and he just dropped it in this pub and it was fabulous.
Amazing. Okay, well, we'll take you back. Let's take a listen to Gloria by Umberto Tozzi. That was Gloria by Umberto Tozzi, chosen by my guest this afternoon, Irvin Welch. I hope that had you breaking out some of your best moves there in Edinburgh, Irvin. Bringing us up then to 1993, Trainspotting is published. That's what, 31 years now after its publication. Did you have any idea back when you were sitting in Edinburgh in your local government job, writing away, that this book could change your life, have such an impact on the cultural landscape to this day?
The thing about writing a book is that it's just a sheer joy to write any book. I just love it, and I love it to this day. But you can't really be responsible for how they're received. It's an act of giving away. You write something, you do your best, and then you give it away. And it's not yours after that. It becomes the world. It's a sheer gift to the world, really. And sometimes the world will go like, brilliant, good on you, Welshie. And other times they'll go like, who cares, mate? You know what I mean? So you can never tell. You know what I mean? It's like I've had books that have done really well commercially. I've had ones that haven't done so well, but I've really enjoyed them all. And sometimes the ones I've enjoyed most have been the ones that have been not as successful. But it's nice to have something like that that is, because it was the first book, it kind of launched me at a level that I wouldn't have had if I'd been sort of building up to it. And I kind of became this sort of literary phenomenon in a way. And it was like, I was sort of, it was a fabulous thing to happen. And very, very lucky because the first publisher published it and it became an instant, it was the biggest publisher in the UK. And it became an instant, sort of almost an instant bestseller. It was a cult book first, and it was a national bestseller, and it was an international bestseller. In between that, you had the stage play, and then you had the film, and it was like so. Sort of, and you still do now. It's a go-to book for youth, and every sort of few years or so, there's another generation of young people that discover it, and it's great. It's like. And I go and do talks and readings on it, and I'm just getting older all the time, and the audience is getting younger all the time. It's just a bizarre kind of thing. But even when it was getting published, I thought myself, this is a book of the 80s. I handed it in, I think, in 1990. It didn't come out to 1993. I think I handed it. I finished it in 1990. Handed it in 91, and I thought this is going to, nobody's going to be interested because it's a book about the 80s primarily. But it became a kind of a poster book for kind of, for what was going on in the youth culture at the time.
And becoming that literary phenomenon, as you describe it, at the time and even now, the famous Choose Life monologue, such an iconic part of our culture now and then, and the iconography that went with the poster, the soundtrack, and the Choose Life, Choose a Job, Choose a Career, Choose a Family. What that meant then, back in 1993 versus now, do you think the meaning has changed? Do you think we have a different type of control, a power over our own lives and societies?
I think we have much less control now. I think it's kind of more, in some ways, the reason the book stuck around is that it's more pertinent than ever. I mean, the book was really about, it was kind of seen as a drugs book, it was seen as a youth book, but really the book is about the collapse of work, basically of paid work, and what we do when we've come to the end of paid work. And it's like, this is what it hit the industrial working classes in Britain first, and that's what it was about. It was about that. What do you do when the work goes? And now everybody's in the same boat. We're all members of the precariat, and we're all having to work out, what do we do when we can't monetize what we do? How do we get by? What kind of lives do we lead? What is happening to the world that we're living in? What does that say about our relationship with the economy, with the corporations, with the state, with all these institutions that we're supposed to be a part of and supposed to have some kind of connection with? So I think, yes, it's interesting the way that it's kind of stood the test of time.
Your third music choice today is Overkill, a Men at Work song, but this is an acoustic version by Colin here from the band. Let's take a listen.
Hello between the sheets only brings exasperation. It's time to walk the streets, smell the desperation. At least there's pretty lights, though there's little variation. It nullifies the night from overkill. Day after day it reappears. Night after night my heartbeat shows the fear. Appear and fade away. Come back another day.
Colin here there with Overkill, the third music choice of writer Irvine Welsh. What does that song mean to you? What does it say to you, Irvine?
Well, the funny thing was about, Men at Work originally did that as, I think it was the second big single after Down Under, Australian band. And Colin Hay was Scottish, and he emigrated to Australia. And even though he was sort of fronting this band, he still had quite a very broad Scottish accent. I never really thought that much about the single, Men at Work single, the Overkill single. And then I was living in Chicago. I just moved to the States, and Colin Hay was playing a gig. And I thought, I'll go and see Colin Hay, because just made me feel a bit more Scottish, basically, in Chicago, and a bit, And he came on the stage, and he played this acoustic version of Overkill. It was just one of these moments when a performer just really taps into something, and I just felt I really got the song. It's quite a melancholy kind of sad kind of song about anxiety and dislocation, and so it kind of chimed with me at the time, and I just thought, this is a great version of that song.
You've lived all over the world there. Just speaking of dislocation, you've lived in Amsterdam, Barcelona, Chicago, San Francisco, Miami, but you've also lived in Dublin, I think, in the 2000s at the height of the Celtic Tiger years, and you've been in and out of Dublin a lot over the years. What changes have you seen here in the city every time you've come back?
The thing that I love about Dublin is that people just have it. They go out and they have it and they enjoy life. And it's like post-Celtic Tiger, there was this recession plane. Everything was, you know, after the crash and all that, everything was supposed to go back. And people just said, no, we're not having it. You know, we're just going, we're still going out. I mean, it's like, we're not going back to the 80s. And I remember the 70s and 80s, I used to go to Dublin as a kid because I had Irish relatives, was pretty grim. It was a very grim place. And people just said, you know, after the Celtic Tiger, no, we're not going back to that. We're just not. We're going out. We're having it. You know, it's like the Celtic Tiger's over when we say it's over. And, you know, and they've just, by the sheer kind of force of belief and enjoyment and all that, and sort of by the spirit of it, they've just kept, you know, people have just kept it going. And it has such a, it always has such a great vibe. Now, I know that people living there will say, well, no, it's changed, it's kind of, and everybody says that about where they come from. But to me, when you compare Dublin to British cities of a similar size, it's really sort of managed to hold on to a lot of vibrancy that it's had from that time.
Let's take your fourth music choice now. You've picked a David Bowie track, Be My Wife. I'm curious, did you ever get to meet him over the years? Were you a big fan?
A massive fan, absolutely. Kind of, he was like a one-man art school for working-class kids in Britain. But, you know, because he was very incredibly generous performer. He told you everything he was listening to. He told you all these sources. He told you all the, you know, he told, this is the soul I'm listening to. This is the German kind of Kraftwerk stuff I'm listening to. This is like right up into jungle, and so, you know, he was just. Because artists are usually quite circumspect about that. They don't like to give away trade secrets, but he was incredibly open. You know, this is the literature I'm reading. I'm reading Burroughs and, the Beat Generation poets and all that. And, so I think you got a kind of big education from him. He was a real educator. I did not meet him because I felt that I would turn into this 14-year-old kind of, an embarrassing fan. You know, I wouldn't give him any dignity. I'd just be, who played on who was the best guitarist in Scary Monsters, do you think? Do you think it was Chuck Hammer or Robert Fripp or Carlos Alomar? You know, so I'd come up with all this crap, like, you know.
But you had invitations to meet him, but did you just take the line, never meet your heroes?
Yeah, well, I sort of, he launched Trainspotting in America, and I was supposed to go in New York and kind of meet him and to launch the film with him. And I just thought, I can't meet Barry. I can't meet him in these circumstances. And so he watched him, my movie, you know, and all that. So I just thought, nah, I'm not. So I ended up in Leith in the pub quiz in the Windsor Bar that night.
Instead of meeting David Bowie.
Yeah, another chance at the Glass Spider tour. He wanted to meet me in the Ubiquitous Chip, and I was actually going to the gig. And I just thought, I can't meet Bowie. I don't want him to be a real person. I want him to be this iconic god. And that's when, you know, he has kind of died as an iconic god in my eyes. And, you know, it's funny because I've become really good friends with Iggy Pop down the years. And he says to me, you're crazy, Irvine. You would have got on so well with David that you guys would have really hit it off. You know, so I could have, and maybe I should have. Maybe it's I regret, but I don't regret it. I like the idea that he's up there, you know, in the gods in my eyes.
And you can remember him purely through the music. Well, let's take a listen to David Bowie, Be My Wife.
Sometimes you get nowhere. I've lived all over the world. I've left every place. Oh,
so lonely.
Be My Wife, the fourth music choice of writer Irvin Welsh. I can't let you go, Irvin, without asking you for your take on the UK general election campaign now underway. I know you're outspoken on many social platforms, particularly X, when it comes to all things politicking and campaigning. A lot of the polls there are suggesting a landslide Labour victory. Do you think that will play out as forecast in July?
Probably. I don't think it'll be quite as big as people are thinking, but it will be quite a considerable victory because, what the Conservatives did, what they've been doing, kind of looting the country when it's been in a pandemic, is kind of unforgivable. You know, they're not public servants. They've exploited and kind of, you know, they've basically taken the piss out of everybody, and I think that people are very vengeful and very kind of down on them. So that should be enough to get substantially over the line for Labour. But, you know, Labour aren't liked either. You know, they're seen as, I think, largely just part of the same thing, and just not even Tory light, but just pretty much the same thing. Maybe slightly less corrupt, or they will be slightly less corrupt for at least the first term. I don't really like politicians or political parties. I just feel that now we're in the era of the professional politician. You shouldn't be a professional politician. You should be a public servant. You should be there because you want to serve the people that you're representing, you're supposed to represent. Unfortunately, they don't represent the people. They represent other interests, kind of powerful global corporate international interests, and they're not really there to do anything for the people in the country.
Okay, well, we'll watch with interest. Will you, for now, introduce your final music selection, Irvin, which is going to be Love Song by Simple Minds. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I mean, the Simple Minds are brilliant. Like, you know, they're just one of these bands, and it's great to see them back and all that. And this is a song that I've always loved. I just love the kind of, you know, the power and the dynamism of it. And they're just so far kind of ahead of the time, really, and particularly this track is absolutely blinding.
Well, author and DJ Irvin Welsh, thank you so much for joining us and bringing us through your musical selections. And listeners can catch Irvin perform at Beyond the Pale Music and Arts Festival in Glendalough, County Wicklow, the weekend after next. Tickets are available from itsbeyondthepale.ie. This is Irvin's final music choice. It's Love Song by Simple Minds.